From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We start this hour with news that the Department of Homeland Security will, for the first time, issue cybersecurity regulations for pipeline operators, requiring that pipeline companies report cyber incidents to federal authorities. The Washington Post broke this story that the Transportation Security Administration, yes, the TSA, which most of us encounter at airports, will release and oversee mandatory regulations in the coming weeks. Now, some lawmakers want that role to go to the Department of Energy. Others say the TSA knows pipelines. Washington Post reporter Lori Aretani is here. And Lori, this is all in response to that ransomware attack on the Colonial Pipeline Company this month. It forced an 11-day shutdown, gas shortages. The pipeline owners said they paid a $4 million ransom. Now, there have been hundreds of hacks, but this one seems to have shaken people up.
This one did indeed, because you could see the gas lines. This one really got the public's attention, and clearly it got the officials at TSA's attention. This is an agency that for nearly 20 years has really relied on voluntary compliance to ensure that the nation's pipeline system was protected from things like cyber attacks. Clearly, they believe that that is no longer working, and so they're going to take more aggressive steps.
And to remind people, the TSA was formed after 9/11. It is under the umbrella of the Department of Homeland Security. But what's the debate over the TSA being the overseer of these regulations?
The issue is, and that we're finding, is that TSA is really focused on its aviation mission. Its other role in surface transportation, including pipelines, isn't as well known and isn't as well staffed and funded. So in many cases, you may have, I think we have 2.7 million miles of pipeline. Mm. There are about 3,000 pipeline companies. And TSA at one point had maybe 14 people in this division. So there is a concern about whether TSA has the resources and also the knowledge. It wasn't until 2010 that they published cybersecurity recommendations for companies to follow. And it's not clear that the agency has the expertise. In fact, in testimony over the last few years, agency officials have said, well, TSA doesn't necessarily have that expertise in their pipeline division. So I think they are making an effort to get more cyber expertise and team it with people that have pipeline expertise.
Yeah. Well, your reporting reminds us that while big electric power and nuclear power plants have mandatory standards, dams, water systems, and as you just said, gas lines, you know, have some recommendations and guidance. And the reason that the TSA couldn't get the mandatory in recent years was resistance from the U.S. Chambers of Commerce to regulations. So what will these new regulations we're going to hear about in the coming days be?
So the first set that we're going to hear, we're going to have published, companies are going to have to report cyber incidents. This wasn't a requirement before, but it will be a requirement now. Companies are also going to have to have a designated official, a chief information security officer, for example, with a direct line to TSA and to an agency within DHS called the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency that is a cyber specialist unit. So they're going to need to have a 24/7 direct connection so that they can let government know if there are incidents. And also, TSA is going to require, or it's going to ask companies to do in this first security directive, an evaluation of their systems against the existing guidelines to see where they stand. In coming weeks, there's going to be a follow-up security directive that is going to make compliance with these requirements and these standards mandatory. And companies that don't do that will face potential fines. So before, TSA relied on companies to do the right thing. If fuel isn't flowing, if things aren't flowing through those pipelines, companies don't make any money. So TSA for many years felt that companies would do the right thing because it was in their best interest. But as the Colonial Pipe Act shows us, that may not be. It's not clear what happened or why. You know, I think the investigation is still ongoing. But TSA is doing the security directives because it's something they can do right away. They do have the authority to do this, and for the first time in nearly 20 years, they're going to exercise that.
Washington Post reporter Lori Aretani, thank you.
Thank you.
Three of the nation's biggest banking groups are rallying against $4 billion of government debt relief to farmers of color. The banks argue that if farmers pay back their debt all at once, it will cut into the profits the banks make off the interest. The federal relief funds were set aside as part of President Biden's coronavirus relief plan, and it's intended to lessen the burden of debt on a historically disadvantaged group of farmers. The money is expected to go out in late June. With us to talk more about this is John Boyd Jr. He's a fourth-generation farmer in Virginia and president of the National Black Farmers Association. John, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for being here. So these payments mark a turning point. Essentially, the U.S. is acknowledging the racism and discrimination in its farming industry that goes back hundreds of years. What will this debt relief do for Black farmers and other farmers of color?
Well, basically, I've been working on the debt relief provision for about 30 years in Congress, but it will help many needy Black farmers and farmers of color who are struggling right now. And there's still many hurdles to cross and rivers to cross as well. So we've been struggling for a very, very long time. And hopefully we're reaching a turning point where we can start heading in the right direction as far as participating in the USDA programs and services and loans and all of these things.
Well, when I spoke with you back in March, when this measure was introduced, you said the biggest obstacle for Black farmers for generations has been access to credit. And, yes, and the credit you get often takes twice as long. The interest is high. What's your reaction to the stiff resistance from banks on this debt relief? They're essentially saying you paying off your loans will cut into their profits and hurt investors.
Right. And, you know, this is a banking industry who was bailed out by the American people. And here they are beating on Black farmers and farmers of color. Instead of coming out with a loan program that would service and help Black and other farmers of color, they're out speaking out against the payments and worrying about what's going into their pockets. But if they open up their bank coffers and lend out more money to Blacks and other small-scale farmers, they will continue to make money.
Well, the complaints that come from three banking associations that represent the banks, they've gone so far to say that they'd be less inclined to loan to farmers of color if the loans were wiped out all at once. They're asking the government to actually pay out more to cover the interest that they'd lose. But on the subject of being less inclined to lend to farmers of color, this is actually the opposite outcome that you've been fighting for the last few decades.
That's what I've been trying to do, to get the banks to lend us money. And here they are coming out. It's almost in a threatening demeanor towards Black farmers. You know, if this happens, we're not going to lend you any more money. And those persons, the banks should be held accountable, not only by the National Black Farmers Association, but from the American public. And that's what people need to start taking a look at. Why is it always when Blacks get a little bit of justice, we get all of this resistance, and this time from someone I didn't see coming, the banking industry.
There's also something else, probably what you did see coming. In April, a group of white farmers actually sued the Department of Agriculture on the grounds that these payments were racist against them. Is this the reaction that you expected?
Well, you know, it's a continuation of history where Blacks were enslaved on American soil and sharecroppers and survived Jim Crow. And you heard me talk about the length of time I've tried to get debt relief. None of the primarily white farm groups signed on to any of the letters, including the banks didn't either. But what about when you got all of the money, all of the time, a $500 billion since the 90s, 99% of that went to white farmers. And they never saw it as a problem when Blacks didn't get anything, when we were representing 14%. Of the America's farmers, and now we're less than 1%. They never spoke out against that.
Well, John, the reality is that the farming industry has seen a tremendous shift over the last few decades.
Yes.
You all rely on each other, regardless of race, right? I mean, usually farmers work in larger organizations, and those include both white and Black farmers and other farmers of color. Do you feel like, though, these payments drive a wedge in those organizations?
I believe, and the history here speaks for itself, that former President Trump drove the wedge between Blacks and white farmers that administration and Sonny Perdue was the worst agriculture secretary in my tenure towards Black farmers, where he said, you guys had to get big or get out of farming. So it's gotten worse. And the only way to make it better is to have a real race conversation in the agriculture industry for Blacks and whites. And let's flush this stuff out and have a real conversation. And for the record, I'm not against any farmer getting the help that they really need when Mother Nature and all of these things affect us. But we shouldn't be affected by discrimination in this country. And that's what I'm saying. It just shows the continuing of how Black farmers and other farmers of color have been treated in this country.
That was John Boyd Jr., president of the National Black Farmers Association. John, thank you so much for speaking with us again.
Thank you for having me.
Back in the early 90s, it was a test of endurance as a kid to see how long we could stay up during the summers to watch late-night TV. And boy, was overnight programming a world of its own. One face that kept us entertained for years during those hours was Byron Allen and his one-hour series profiling film and TV stars.
Byron Allen coming to you from Entertainment Studios, and this is Kickin' It.
Let's make a movie, people.
Well, the story behind Allen's TV career is just as amazing as his current fortunes. Allen is one of the few Black Americans to own and operate a major media company, which includes ownership of the Weather Channel and the production of several popular judge and game shows. And he's now taking on what he says is inequality and racism in the industry, one lawsuit at a time. This month, Allen filed a $10 billion lawsuit against McDonald's, alleging the fast food company practiced racial discrimination for not advertising on Black-owned media outlets. And on the business front, Allen is now expanding his broadcast empire. This spring, he purchased 7 local TV stations for nearly $380 million. And he also launched Local Now, a streaming app for local news, weather, sports, and traffic. We caught up with each other recently, and I asked him why he's setting his sights on local news.
Well, I think local media is very important. And, you know, as we saw in this last pandemic, it was essential news and information because people needed to know what's going on with COVID-19 in their community. And these television stations, they are pillars of the community. The Quincy family has been in the media business since 1891. They decided to sell the assets to some friends of ours at Gray. And Gray had some overlap markets. They bought quite a few markets from Quincy. But in 7 of the markets, they already owned television stations. And those are the 7 markets that we purchased out of the Gray-Quincy divestiture. These are ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox affiliates. So in the last almost 18 months, I've invested close to $1 billion buying Big Four network affiliates because, listen, it's a great business. And the good news is we all 4 networks, all 4 of them secured NFL football out to 2033. And we know that NFL football is the true religion of America.
Right, right. Well, to your point, we understand how important local news is to communities. But that industry has had a hard go over the last decade or so. The revenue streams have been hijacked by the ability for local news consumers to get headlines anywhere. The solution is a code that no one has quite cracked yet, but you're investing money in places where a lot of people have given up. What do you think we're missing about the discussion about local media?
Oh, wow. I mean, local media will always be here. You know, I'm a firm believer in local news and information. So when I bought the Weather Channel in March of 2018, they said, oh, by the way, you own something that's the equivalent of a fully distributed broadcast network that uses proprietary software and artificial intelligence to curate, aggregate, produce, and stream local news, weather, sports, and traffic geofence to the user's zip code. And I went, wow. I said, that is genius. They said, yes, but don't fall in love with it. I said, why not? I'm already in love. And they said, because it loses over 25 million a year. and you're probably going to want to shut it down. And I said, absolutely not. And I have personally invested over $100 million of my capital to reposition the asset, and I've put it in beta for the last a little over 3 years. And what I said is that, you know, let's make this free. So now we have about 10,000 movies and TV shows and documentaries and over 300 plus channels. Bloomberg has a channel there. Kevin Hart has a channel there. Johnny Carson, People Magazine. And they're able to watch all the content they want for free. And a lot of people, they watch it on their big screen TVs.
Well, Byron, do you think the biggest challenge at this point is getting the attention of people, because there's so many choices though now?
No, because I think what happens is that in the digital world, things grow so rapidly. You know, I'm so used to hearing, yeah, our TV division grew, you know, this second quarter, 8% over last year's second quarter. We're up 8%. All right, big applause. Everybody's happy we're up. Now you have to take off your linear world to put on your digital ears for the digital world. And they will say things like the traffic at local now is up 88%, not last year, last month. And things grow so rapidly because you're able to go experience the app. And if you enjoy the app, you're immediately going to share it with all your friends and your loved ones. And they keep sharing it. And it really is amazing how fast it grows. With no real promotion of local now, most people don't even know about local now.
So I guess the challenge is also timing. I'm thinking about Quibi, which you're very familiar with. It seemed like a great idea, but it came right before the pandemic.
I mean, listen, I think Jeffrey Katzenberg did a terrific job with Quibi. I think the challenging thing is we're in a world where people really love the word free. And I think what happens is people are starting to make those choices. Do they want to keep, you know, their cable bill? And I hope they do, because we have the Weather Channel. And I think the cable industry will be great and do just fine because of broadband and other great reasons. We have a lot of sports and what have you. But I also think folks are going to want to have access to other content that's free. And I think Local Now fits the bill. And I think that super hyper local news and information is very important, because we do live in a complicated world and you need that information in real time.
In addition to local news, Alan and I also got to talking about other topics, like his entry into entertainment. When he was a kid, he and his mother moved from Detroit to L.A., where she became one of the first interns for NBC Studios. She worked her way up to become a publicist, and Alan spent a lot of time with her in the studios, getting a crash course of sorts in the entertainment industry.
And I would go out to NBC quite often, and I was able to watch Johnny Carson tape The Tonight Show almost every day or every other day, especially in the summers. And I was able to go across the hall and watch Red Fox do Sanford and Son, and then go down the hall and watch Freddie Prinze do Chico and the Man. And I watch an unknown weatherman do a game show, Pat Sajak. He was on the, and I watch an unknown sportscaster do the sports, and he would go on to become Brian Gumbel. And I would just go from studio to studio to studio. And I just said, this is what I want to do with my life. I want to be a comedian. I want to make people laugh. I want to inform people, entertain people. I want to make the world better.
This turned into, by the time you were 18, you being the youngest comic to ever be on The Tonight Show, which eventually led to a role on the reality show in the early 80s, Real People, then your own shows, then your comedy specials.
That's right.
And then you decided to start your own media company. I mean, it makes sense because you were entrenched in this entertainment world. So you knew the entertainment as well as the business of it.
That's right. When I went to Jimmy's Place, on his writing staff was me, David Letterman, and Jay Leno. And I was getting 25 bucks a joke, and Jay and Dave were getting 200 bucks a week. So that just, I want people to know, everybody sees us when we're on national TV, and they see us when we own this and that, but they don't see us when we're getting nothing, or 25 bucks a joke, or 200 bucks a week.
And this gets to the point that Alan has been pushing for years: economic inclusion, specifically for Black-owned media companies. In addition to suing McDonald's, back in 2015, Alan filed a $20 billion lawsuit against Comcast and Charter Communications, claiming his TV channels weren't offered its cable bundles because of racism. The case made its way to the Supreme Court last year. Byron later withdrew the case as part of a settlement. And I asked him what he gained from that experience.
You know, I wrote an op-ed, and the op-ed that I wrote last summer, Black America Speaks, America Should Listen. And I said, you know, what we need to do to never come back here again, because we have to really deal with the issues and why we are here where we are. Coretta Scott King was a friend of mine, Martin Luther King's widow. She said, they killed my Martin over the speech he gave at Stanford University, The Other America, where he said there are two Americas. Mm-hmm. And one America has access to opportunity, jobs, bank loans, and education. The other America doesn't. And two Americas won't survive. When she said that to me, it changed my life. It changed the way I saw the world. And, you know, being the youngest comedian on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson at 18, that is all wonderful and amazing. And I'm very blessed to have had those opportunities. And I really appreciate it. But this is the important work. This is the work where we make America stronger. And the way we make America strong forever is we have to achieve one America. What does that mean? That means we need to have equal justice for every American, economic inclusion for every American. And we need to have a safe environment for every American. And for Black America, you know, America, you're killing us in the schoolroom by making sure we don't have a proper education. You're killing us in the boardroom by making sure we don't have real economic inclusion. And you're killing us in the courtroom by making sure we don't have equal justice long before you choke us to death in the street. And that's not a survivable scenario for America. And we have to come together and be one America as a matter of survival.
That was Byron Allen, CEO and founder of Allen Media Group Entertainment Studios, talking with us about his latest acquisitions, his start in the industry, and why he believes economic inclusion is so important.
What happens after a police officer shoots someone who's unarmed? For decades in California, internal affairs investigations, how the police themselves, were secret. Until now. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
The European Union has now imposed additional sanctions on Belarus after that Eastern European country forced a Ryanair flight to Lithuania to land in Belarus under a false claim of a bomb threat, a pretense for arresting Roman Protasevich, a prominent opposition journalist from Belarus who was on board. So what questions does this now raise for the airline industry? Here now is transportation analyst Seth Kaplan is here. And Seth, we know some countries are now ordering their airlines to avoid the airspace over Belarus. The EU advised them to do so. How big a deal is this?
Well, first, you just start with the logistics of that. And indeed, if you look at one of those websites or apps where you can see live radar, Flight Radar 24, or FlightAware, one of those, there's basically this big hole over Belarus right now. You see airplanes all over Europe, except there, as flights have begun again in the aftermath of the pandemic, but not over Belarus. And so that tells you that airlines are basically having to fly out of the way, having to spend more on fuel, that sort of thing, add time to their flight, where they usually would have flown over Belarus.
Well, a lot of airlines saying they're not even going to travel over the country at all, which means you can't fly in or out of Belarus, right? To Western Europe, at least.
Right. And you know, not a lot of demand right now, probably,
for that, yeah.
You know, because of what's happening, right? Exactly, in terms of actually flying to or from there. And the greater impact there is, just the fact that airlines typically overfly Belarus. It is along a lot of common routes. So even a lot of us who have never been to Belarus, like myself, have almost certainly flown over it if we've flown ever between Europe and Asia, let's say.
Yeah. Well, so to what the leader of Belarus did, what power does a country have over a flight routing through its airspace? You know, we're reading there are laws about using your military against a civilian plane.
Yeah, this is, you know, they here are basically accused of tricking Ryanair into landing there, right? Generally, the relationship is that an airline and its passengers are basically customers of the country they're overflying. Airlines pay what are called overflight fees to the country that funds the air traffic control system. And in exchange for that, they're supposed to get safe passage over the country and depend on the fact that whatever air traffic controllers are telling them is for safety reasons. There have been times, of course, over the years where things have gone horribly wrong, but those are very much the exception. And this now prominent on that list of incidents. We can remember tragically the Malaysian airliner shot down over Ukraine, the Russians accused of shooting it down back in 2014, for example. And now this.
Well, what does this all mean, Seth Kaplan, to the average U.S. traveler who may be thinking, oh, I might fly to Europe or fly to Asia, as you said, this summer?
Less than other incidents, even ones that weren't allegedly nefarious, have meant simply because of the geography. Again, if you just picture where Belarus is, it's not between New York and Paris or New York and London. You might remember, Robin, I guess it's about a decade ago now, that volcano in Iceland was so disruptive because Iceland is right along the path between so many American cities and so many European cities. So even though nobody was accused of doing anything wrong, that was terribly disruptive to the summer travel season. This a little bit less so for Americans just because of the geography.
Right. Well, we know the UN's International Civil Aviation Organization is going to meet tomorrow and they are going to take a look at all of this. Seth Kaplan here now is transportation analyst. What an incredible story, Seth. Thank you.
Is President Joe Biden the next Franklin D. Roosevelt or Lyndon B. Johnson, a mix of both or something totally different? It's difficult, of course, to assess what Biden's legacy will be. He's just getting started. But leading presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin says Biden is already taking after those two men. She recently spoke with NPR's Sam Sanders after she attended a top secret meeting of presidential historians at the White House. And Sam joins us now. He's the host of NPR's podcast, It's Been a Minute. Hey, Sam.
Thank you for having me.
So a secret meeting, huh? Did Doris Kearns Goodwin give you any insight on what they discussed?
She would give me none, you know. So, like, there were some leaks in some other outlets. I think Axios got to talk to some of the other historians who were there, which included, you know, Eddie Glad and Michael Beschloss and Michael Eric Dyson, among others. But it was supposed to be top secret. And they talked about what Biden's place in history might be. There were a lot of comparisons to FDR and LBJ. And I do know that at one moment, Biden looked over at Doris Kearns Goodwin in this secret meeting and said to her, I'm no FDR, but, and she won't tell me what he said after that. But I think this says a lot about Joe Biden.
So is this kind of par for the course where a newly elected president meets with historians?
It happens, but it hadn't happened for a few years. You'll recall when Donald Trump took office years ago, some of his first big guests at the White House were Ted Nugent and Sarah Palin. So this was a return to some previous presidencies. But I do think what I found the most interesting in the fact that Joe Biden had this big secret meeting with the historians was that it really underscored how big he wants to go in the White House. You know, he wants to draw these comparisons to big policy initiatives from FDR and LBJ, Great Society, the New Deal. And this idea, I think, that existed about Biden during the campaign, that he was just this kind of slow, quiet, aging moderate who just wanted to go along to get along, that's being disproven.
Well, here's Kearns Goodwin on your show talking about the comparisons to FDR, who Biden invoked during his joint session to Congress earlier this year.
The philosophy of government that FDR put forward when he came in was that government would be responsible for what was happening in the economy and in the social structure. And that was not the thought before. Federal government wasn't supposed to be that responsible. And Biden, I think, has created that philosophy back, that the government has a philosophic responsibility for what's happening. And so by likening that back to the New Deal, it recreates that philosophy that has somewhat been undermined in the last 40 years.
What else does Kearns Goodwin say? Yeah, about how Biden is trying to bring back that philosophy.
Since the Great Depression, after that, there was this universal idea, pretty much, that the government needed to be involved in things like the economy, in things like the social structure. But Ronald Reagan changed all of that. You know, he said famously during his presidency, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And he ushered in this era for decades where Democrats and Republicans argued for smaller government. And Joe Biden now is wanting a return to the kind of government that FDR FDR was preaching, which was a larger, more expansive government that helps folks in all kinds of ways in their lives.
But President Biden is also looking at a Congress that is deeply divided. Did you all talk about that and partisanship while trying to really get all of these bills passed?
Yeah. You know, so Doris Kearns Goodwin, she made it really clear that the partisanship that Biden is facing in the country right now is unlike anything that FDR or LBJ were dealing with when they were proposing their big policy initiatives. Media has become more partisan. The parties have moved further away from each other. And we listen to different stuff. You know, Doris told me that when FDR was given his fireside chats, 8 out of 10 people would listen on the radio. There's nothing that unites us like that right now. So it is an environment of increased partisanship that is unlike anything that those other guys had to face before.
There's this sense of urgency that the president is also projecting. He's jumped right into, as you said, these big ideas. Let's listen to Kearns Goodwin explain this to you.
Where it's really like LBJ is that both of them came into office, as we know, in time of crisis. But both were men of Congress in a way that FDR wasn't. Hmm. They both waited for this moment all their lives. When you think about how long LBJ had been in public service, as Biden was, and they both believed that the crisis had created an opportunity for action.
This is fascinating. They both waited for this moment all of their lives. That is a distinction. There's a parallel there that they both had kind of been in public service for quite a while before taking this top spot.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, Biden's wanted this for a very long time. You'll remember, he's run for president a few times before, and people still talk about whether or not he should have run after he was vice president. He wants this. And I think that we're probably going to be surprised in this presidency to really understand how deliberate he is. He's also already managed to do something pretty remarkable. He is uniting a party in Democrats that are kind of all over the map. You know, with all of these big things that, you know, all kinds of presidents come into office saying they want to do, it remains to be seen how much of it gets passed. But to see what he's proposing, free education, free pre-K, free community college, expanding Medicaid, dealing with child care, paying for home health care, he is trying to make those new factions of his party happy while also, you know, keeping the establishment there, this establishment that knows him and trusts him from his decades in politics.
Well, there's so much more to watch for. That's Sam Sanders, host of NPR's podcast, It's Been a Minute, talking about his conversation with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. As always, thank you so much, Sam.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, this week, we're reflecting on the impact of the murder of George Floyd, a black man killed by a white police officer in Minneapolis just over a year ago. There were memorials held around the country yesterday, moments of silence, including one at St. Louis Park High School near Minneapolis. The school group Students Organized for Anti-Racism, or SOAR, led conversations with their peers about how to be an ally and the changes they want to see moving forward. We've gathered some of their thoughts. Here's Junior Ezra Hudson.
Specifically, since it happened like during COVID lockdown, like George Floyd and everything like that, I feel like people weren't able to talk amongst each other and grow with each other. So I feel like that's another thing we want to see.
Student organizers said they felt traumatized, sorrowful, anxious after Floyd's death. Some channeled that into anti-racism activism in the streets. Here's Junior Lily Jamsa.
It makes me want to actually put my boots on the ground and do something about it and use my privilege as I can to help others that need their voices to be heard more. And I've been going out to protest with my family, which is like a big step. I've been doing more research like on African-American history in general to be more aware.
Senior Grace Kinyuku says one way she's been an ally is in questioning the curriculum at school.
At our school, there's an AP Euro class. However, I questioned a lot why there has to specifically be like a college level class for the entirety of Europe. And then the only alternative is just everything else, that kind of thing.
So there have been conversations at school and conversations at home. Freshman Calvin Zimmerman, who is black, says he started having new conversations with his dad, who's white.
For one, a conversation was what to do if the police pull you over, something that my dad didn't realize he'd have to have a talk with me about until this happened. We had some sort of brief thing when I was 10, but at that time, how are you going to tell a 10-year-old that your life is on the line when you're just trying to get home or something like that? So that definitely was eye-opening to me, especially coming from my dad.
And Calvin says he's glad there is more awareness about racism today compared to a year ago, after not just Floyd's death, but others like Dante Wright, who was shot by an officer who says she mistook her gun for a taser. But Calvin's frustrated that interest seems to fade.
It's like, do we need to wait for another George Floyd to happen? Do we need for another Dante Wright to happen before something like a movement starts again? It shouldn't be like this. This should be going on and on. But once we get the bare minimum, the ball just seems to stop rolling. And that's not right. In my opinion, that's just not okay for me.
Voices of students from St. Louis Park High School near Minneapolis, part of a school group called Students Organized for Anti-Racism, SOAR, speaking a year after the murder of George Floyd.
Hey, have you had enough cicada talk yet? Well, prepare your ears because you're about to hear a lot more of them in the coming weeks. After 17 years underground, billions of those beady-eyed insects, no bigger than your thumb, are emerging across the U.S. for the mating season. Whether you know nothing about the bugs or can hear their drones right outside of your window, Here and Now's Alexander Turk gets us up to speed.
On a Friday afternoon, I got an email. The chorus in the treetops is starting. Get here now. I grab my microphone and I hop on the highway for Columbia, Maryland. And as I pull into the suburban neighborhood, I hear a chorus 17 years in the making.
This is Brood 10, 17-year periodical cicadas. That's the big boy band up in the treetop. Right now it's all about romance.
I'm here with Mike Raup. He's an entomologist at the University of Maryland. He comes out wearing a black shirt that says Magicicada 2021. No wonder he calls himself the bug guy.
After spending 17 years underground, the cicada nymphs will emerge, usually at nightfall. They'll go to a vertical structure. Could be a tree, could be a fence, could be you if you stand still long enough. They're going to attach with their front legs, and then that exoskeleton or skin is going to split down the middle. The beautiful adult cicada will emerge.
He kneels down to grab a handful of brown cicada shells ringing the tree.
This is 6 inches deep of cicada shells.
Within 4 to 6 days, they'll mature and join what Raup calls the cicada palooza.
And then the male cicada is going to use his very best performance to try to convince that special someone that she should be the mother of his nymphs. If she likes his performance, if it's really good, she'll flick her wings and make a little clicking sound. Then they'll hook up, mate, and they'll go about the next phase of the game, which for her is to move out the tips of small branches to lay her eggs. For him, well, he's probably going to saunter off and maybe find another female to court. Well, let's walk over here and take a look at this garden fence. You can see they've been emerging for several days. This happens to be a little female cicada. We can tell because at the tip of her abdomen, it's very pointed. That's her egg-laying appendage. We call that the ovipositor. That's what she'll insert into the trees to deposit her eggs in what we call egg nests. Each female cicada can lay as many as 400 to 600 eggs during the course of her lifetime. So there are going to be a lot of cicadas up in these treetops.
So where does that droning chorus come from? Raup plucks a cicada off the garden fence and pulls back a flap on its underside to show me a white and vibrating membrane.
The sound we're listening to is created by the timbal organ of the male. It's like a drum head. There are muscles attached. It can vibrate that drum head. Its abdomen is actually hollow and acts as a reverberation chamber to amplify that sound. When this little guy is up in the treetops with his broodmates and they're all singing in unison, the sound can reach 80 to 100 decibels, so they're going to get really noisy up in the treetops.
So, the romance, the music. But these cicadas also provide a feast for local wildlife, like birds, foxes, even dogs. And I had to ask.
Oh, sure, yeah. I always snack on a few cicadas. My favorites are what we call the soft-shelled cicadas. So after they emerge, the exoskeleton hasn't fully hardened. And I'll usually snack on those. They're very tasty.
I challenged a bug guy. If he'll eat one, I'll eat one. We set off on a hunt for a soft shell, but we have to settle for a different adult entree.
Okay, this little rascal, see how the wings are deformed?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this one doesn't have a hope.
And finally...
1, 2, 3. What did you think? What kind of flavor do you get?
Swiss cheese.
Mm.
You know, I'm more of a cheddar guy. The eggs planted in the trees will take about 6 to 10 weeks to hatch, roughly the lifespan of their parents, barring a fatal interruption by predators or natural selection.
This will be in late July, even August. The tiny nymphs are then going to tumble 80 feet from the tree down to the earth, bounce twice, go underground, and begin to feed on plant roots, sadly, for another 17 years.
When the parents die, their bodies fall and fertilize the trees for their young, and in 17 years, their children will emerge again. A rhythm, Ralph told me, that has boggled the minds of researchers. Some say it's circadian, or cicadian. Others point to fluctuations in their nutrients deep underground. Raup hopes we take the lessons of the past year, a year of turmoil and isolation, and make 2038 a better place for us and for the cicadas.
I'm just hoping that by 2038, when the cicadas come back, maybe the world will be a little friendlier and maybe a little kinder place than it is right now. I got my fingers crossed, and that's what I'd really like to see.
For Here and Now, I'm Alexander Turk.
The poor cicada. He waits 17 years and Alexander Turk eats him.
Right, exactly. He didn't even have a chance to mate.
Didn't have a chance. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.